started June the 30th, we are open for the committee to look at issues for next year's budget. As many of the other proposals that proposed can be looked at for next year's budget. And for that reason, Chair, we've kept at this stage the terms of reference restricted to the fiscal framework. The fiscal framework has been adopted by Parliament. And in terms of, I forget the exact name, the Money Bills Procedure Act, proposals should be in line with the fiscal framework. So, of course, the issue is going to be that if the zero rating does lead to a big reduction in revenue, certainly the revenue gap, we will need proposals on how to fill the revenue gap or what expenditure programs to cut, just to make an obvious point. So that's certainly for the short term. In terms of what happens next year, Chair, the issues and the tax issues are never easy issues. The issues will be still that whatever the rate is for VAT next year, we need taxes to raise the revenue. And underlying it, I think, as Judge Davis said, the philosophical decision to make is what level of expenditure do we want? And do we really think that we could cut back on the expenditure levels that we have? To the extent that we cannot, I think that the levels at which we have the three major taxes are going to stay with us for a while until, you know, you get good economic growth and we go back to the first 15 years or so of our democracy when we were able to consistently lower the major taxes every year in some form or the other, or keep them as they were, like the fact. I think, I don't know if the team has any, have I missed out? Was he speaking tonight?
Just a question on the research and the fiscal impact. I mean, the report that the DTC have done on VAT is section A on the macroeconomic impact of the VAT increase. And Treasury has fed into that process. A lot of the modeling that goes into behind the impact of the different VAT tax changes on the economy have flown into that, and that is published that out there. I mean, similar models were used. But that is certainly not the only, and I think as a civil society organization said, you know, models can go one way or the other. That certainly isn't the only resource base that we use. I mean, there are many other papers that come to a very similar conclusion. The ones that come to mind are the OECD, did a paper on tax and economic growth, and the Bureau of Economic Research have done a paper. And then when we responded on the budget presentation last time, we listed a number of other articles that we can put in our response document that again comes to similar conclusion that corporate income taxes or personal income taxes have a more detrimental impact on growth than value added taxes or consumption taxes. We did in-house research using those models, but we also used that other variety of research that is out there that has been published.
With regard to the issue of public engagement,
we speak into the mic.
Okay. Parliament advised us to do public consultation, and in between there was Easter weekend and everything. That said, we did send an invitation to the civil society, and the turnout was low because the issue was like it was short notice because it was 1 week. And there were issues regarding traveling expenses from Cape Town to Pretoria. Now, we were faced with a situation whereby when we're doing all our taxation laws amendment bill, we normally have public hearings in Pretoria at a set venue, which is DBSA auditorium. So everyone would come there. So now we've got a situation whereby the civil society could not come to Pretoria because of traveling expenses. So we are still trying to see how can we meet them halfway without creating a precedent that whenever there are public hearings on tax issues, we'll go to those towns. But we are going to try to speak and see when, if we are coming to Cape Town, we can maybe arrange a meeting to do the public hearing, the hearing or the engagement with the people that are in Cape Town.
Okay, just on that, and I think Mr. Kareem raised the issue of picking that up with us offline. I think the issue is the panel will be having consultations. It will be having hearings, presumably at a few places, depending on demand. And I think the issue then will be is, do we do this process in parallel, etc. I think we need to sort those things out. But to the extent that we can, you said we will have two meetings. We'll have one in Pretoria, another one, so that we can give more time, and have another one in Cape Town at the very least. And there's a demand to go elsewhere. We can consider that as well. So we're open on the process. But yeah, I do want to end by saying, just the expectations people have. Obviously, people have valid expectations, but I think we are locked in, certainly for the fiscal framework over the next 3 years. And I think, you know, we also don't want to create unrealistic expectations that one can move away from that fiscal framework. That will require you to come back to Parliament and many changes just around that. For now, for the short term, we are focusing on staying within the fiscal framework. Thank you.
Thank you for that input. I think what must be done is carefully do your advanced planning, future planning, in terms of the consultation process. Now, you refer to the north and the south, and Kimberley's in the middle. It's not Bloemfontein, it's Kimberley. That's where I come from, my northern Cape. So contemplate that as well. We can call a lot of people for you to attend the hearing there. Albert Green,
can we talk offline? Nothing can be done. There's this television screen that you have, and so on. And finally, if it comes to it, I know you don't want to fix it, but given the gravity of what's happening here, I think one should look into whether or not we plug in funding. In fact, I thought the research there needs to be funded by you, but you're going to say no. So I think really we want more. But the only saving grace you have now is actually that we can't do things that we plan to. We bring the carbon tax bill forward, we have no choice, because these processes will not follow. Any member of parliament, can you please notify the committee? Any member of parliament is free to attend those sittings that are held, and we're looking to Zakele and Antonio Bingadet.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'll go in here.
I'm sorry to belabor the point, but I want to come back to these fiscal impact studies. So my assumption is that once National Treasury have cobbled together their package of revenue proposals, that the fiscal impact of those revenue proposals is tested with an in-house model. My question to you is that correct? Was the fiscal impact assessed and was a report produced? And if a report was produced, an in-house report, I would like a copy of that report.
Yeah, we do impact studies all the time at various committees. Often it's in the form of PowerPoint slides, maybe not fully written reports, but we try and put almost everything within a budget review and so on, the end product. But we will go back and just collate the report we've had. We don't have any problems with releasing them, but we have to also just check with other divisions so that we get our economic policy people to make an input to SAAB and SAAB itself, frankly.
Fine, let's get on with our agenda. South African Institute for Tax Professionals, you ready? Yes, sir.
We started on the basis of what you said before lunch, that you would give us an opportunity to respond. Are we going to get that opportunity?
I said that what I meant was, when they come back into a full report, then you will reply. This is an immediate one. Otherwise, we're going to end up in case not free on the second one. In other words, what we normally do is they reply at the end, right? We don't normally then ask them to respond. Then what happens is they come with a fuller presentation, going through everything in a detailed grid or table, then you respond, then they respond, then you respond, and we're done. Right? So I just think we should be guarded about what we're doing here now. I'm sure you've got problems. You can write a short note to us. We've already requested them to expand in terms of reference, bearing in mind what they've said, and we asked them to do it within 7 days.
Because, Chair, it has a bearing on what you asked us earlier about our reasonableness. In relation to the 2018 situation. That was based on understanding that there's going to be serious engagement. What we've heard now completely contradicts that, and we may have to review our position and revert on that particular issue, as well as on the court issue, because the message we're getting is that there's absolutely no intention to engage with the intention of changing anything. It's saying we locked into a three-year process. The major taxes are not going to change next year. That's what he said, Chair. We'll take them out. And you know, that sends out a very problematic message. But we will respond formally.
So we will create another day to have a separate sitting where the National Treasury will reply on all the inputs in a written format and invite all the stakeholders to come and be part of that meeting. That's the interpretation. So we're not cutting anything short or cutting anything out. We are actually adding. That's what we are doing. And then all stakeholders will be notified. We've got all your addresses, all your emails, what have you. That's the answer.
Yes, Chair, just to follow up, we're not questioning your procedure. We understand your procedure. We're questioning the nature and the tone and the content of Treasury's responses to the submissions that we made this morning. But we will communicate formally.
Yeah, I'm not saying you look to Parliament to say, not the executive. You know that all so well, yes. They can say what they want to say. But I have a mandate, and so is the co-chair. I said I'll go now. And in fact, let me do this. While you're here, let me go and see. The minister's not in the house. I'm telling you, Younger, you're in charge of the SOC. I'm going now, okay? At 3 o'clock when the bells ring, I'll let half an hour lapse to him. I'm going down to see Minister Nene. I'm going to talk to him, tell you, remember, about the program and so on, about the bills that are coming. I have spoken to Somania yesterday. I need to brief you, by the way, on our exchange, on all the issues. Right? So let me put this to you. Parliament decides. But ultimately, as you well know, we take our cue from the political party. In other words, the government and Parliament doesn't stand for election, the ANC does. We have alerted the Zoning Party, the ETC, about the matter. We're taking it there. COSATU is meant to engage, to be discussing in those structures as well. So there's parallel processes. There's the ANC-led process through the Thule House. There's the parliamentary process. There's the government process. And there's the panel process. And we'll merge and so on. I would urge that you participate in that forum, even if you're unhappy about what Momo and them are saying. Finally, they don't decide. It's Parliament that will decide. And we would really appreciate, because we don't have the technical capacity, right, to do the sort of stuff that the panel can do, and so on. And we're just pleading that you participate in that process. But ultimately, it's your call. You can decide. It's your right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just say something, Neil and your colleagues? There's no other committee that does this that I know of. No other committee. I've asked for panels elsewhere in the world. I can't find them. Maybe Nicaragua, I'm told, in the first 5 years of that euphoric time when you and I and others were so taken by them. And only last week you find out about claims by NGOs that elections have been rigged by the Sandinistas and so on. So, there it is. We can do so much, and finally it's your call. You have a right to do whatever you want. Thank you.
Thank you. Eventually we can get to you. 15 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Erica de Villiers, and I've got with me my colleague Malebo Moloto. We are from the South African Institute of Tax Professionals, and we help our tax practitioner members to be compliant. Now, today we're going to deal with two topics. We have dealt with our views on the increase in the VAT rate from 14% to 15% after the budget. So we're not going to go through that in detail again. But I would just like to say that I really think that one of the positive things that has come out of this is that people in this room and outside of this room are really focusing their minds on the plight of the poor. I would also like to say that I think it's important that in the short to medium term, it's not only looked at from a tax perspective in terms of solutions, like it has been said, that the panel should look at other ways of finding solutions. I will deal with the VAT on e-services, and my level will then just give a bit of feedback on the practical implementation problems that have been experienced with the implementation of the increase in the VAT rate. Now, before I get into the detail on the VAT on electronic services or these cross-border e-services, I would like to just bring to your attention that National Treasury is setting up a workshop for the end of May to engage with the public on this topic, and that is obviously welcomed by us.
Can you repeat that one if everyone hears it?
Yes, I will. At the end of May, National Treasury is busy setting up a workshop for the end of May to consult with the general public on this proposed amendment. The amendments are proposed in the draft VAT bill and regulations that were published with them. They are very complicated and require clarification and reconsideration. And if they're not simplified and clarified, that could give rise to unnecessary disputes. Now, an important point that I'd like to make today is that they are proposed to come into operation on 1 October 2018, which means that the date of promulgation of the relevant legislation is actually likely to be a later date than the effective date of the change. And this implies that the amendments may not be fully consulted on throughout the legislative cycle. I can obviously not predict when the cycle will end. Normally it ends in December. So there is a significant concern amongst various VAT specialists that this doesn't give enough time for consultation on a complicated topic. And people have also brought to my attention that the VAT systems would then also have to be updated to cater for the change once it actually is agreed upon. And therefore, it is recommended that maybe there's a 6-month delay after the promulgation before the changes actually become effective. That's just a guideline. So what is VAT on electronic services? Somebody had to explain this to me because I really didn't know what it meant. We've got rules in South Africa that have been effective from 1 July 2014. But before that, we were just using other rules, general rules, for imported services. And that meant that the playing field wasn't level. So the example is an imported service or an e-service that you can import is if you download a book from Amazon.com. And in that instance, you would only pay 100 rand because nobody would charge you any VAT. And you had the option of charging yourself VAT and nobody did that. Versus if you ordered a book from Kalahari.net, you would actually be charged 114 rand, the old 14 rand VAT on top of the 100 rand cost of the book. So the book would cost you 114 rand. If you get it from Kalahari, whereas if you get it from Amazon, it would cost you 100. So this is clearly not fair, the plan field isn't level, and the revenue service doesn't get their VAT. This example, I'd like to point out, is what is referred to in the VAT world as business to consumer. So the person who buys the book is actually an end consumer and would not be entitled to claim back the VAT because they're not a VAT registered vendor. The current position from 1 July 2014 is that the foreign supplier, such as Amazon, must register for VAT in South Africa, and the South Africa registered recipient of electronic services then pays the VAT. And if it's not a vendor, it cannot claim the input tax back, like I said, business to consumer, so it would cost this consumer 114 rand. But if you are a vendor, you can claim the input tax back. So you pay 114, you claim back 14, and it only costs you really 100 rand, and you are basically back neutral. So that would be a business-to-business scenario. If you register for VAT, generally speaking, if you're a business, then you don't have a VAT cost. Now, at the moment, before the amendment, there are only specific services that are listed as being e-services. And one of the disadvantages of that is that this will change all the time. So you could easily not fall in, just simply because you don't fall into a definition. So games of chance, subscription services and educational services provided that is supplied by means of an electronic agent or electronic communication or the internet. So it comes kind of through the cloud. Whether a service falls in or out is very complex and uncertain. For example, Uber fees. If you pay for an Uber service, are you paying for access to an app, or are you paying Uber to arrange the transport? That's an open question in the backlog. The new proposal introduces a brand new definition of electronic services, and very wide. It will include any services supplied by means of an electronic agent, electronic communications, or the internet for any consideration other than telecommunication and certain educational services. Now, that interpretation will just give rise to further additional complexity and uncertainty. For example, a product where what you pay is for a combination of things, they call it bundled products. Broadcasting, like for example CNN, if you get CNN, is that now an e-service? Professional services, if your advisor, if you use a lawyer overseas and they send you their advice by email, is that now called? And this definition is just too wide to be enforceable. Also, all these definitions are defined, but it's not clear what they mean. So electronic agents, electronic communications, the internet, we need examples of what is meant by this. On business-to-business transactions, other jurisdictions distinguish between business-to-business and business-to-consumer. Because there's an acknowledgement in business-to-consumer transactions where there's actually VAT that is ultimately paid to SARS and not claimed back, that a mechanism is needed to collect the VAT. But on business-to-business transactions, because they're VAT neutral, it doesn't really require that the VAT gets collected in the first place just to be claimed back. And in this current case, business-to-business transactions will also require the vendor to register with SARS without SARS actually getting any net VAT back. So, for example, if Microsoft Corporation sells software via South African supply chain, so it sells it to South African subsidiaries, then it will have to register, even though there will be no VAT that SARS will get from Microsoft Corporation, that is not going back again. So this requirement to register results in a whole lot of unnecessary work because so many foreign companies will have to register as vendors in South Africa. And often you'll have a situation where the VAT situation after you claim back your VAT is the same. You now have more work, and if you don't register, you'll be non-compliant, and then a significant interest and penalty burden could arise. So it really just doesn't make all that much sense. A more simple way of doing this is summarized in this diagram, which basically says that in a business-to-consumer scenario, where the recipient of the goods is not a vendor, the foreign supplier will still have to register because that's the only way to collect the VAT. But if it's a business-to-business scenario and the recipient is a vendor entitled to claim the full input VAT back, then the foreign supplier should not have to register. And in a business-to-business scenario, for example, a bank, where the recipient vendor is not entitled to claim back the full input VAT, then again, the foreign supplier should not register, but the local vendor should have to use a reverse charge mechanism to account for the VAT. It's a technical term, but it's used very widely in many other jurisdictions, which include South America, Arab nations, and the EU. I don't want to start with the US, but anyway. So I guess the bottom line of this is, I think our most important message is there's a lot of complexity already in the system. The complexity will be increased significantly with the widening of the definition. a whole lot of foreign vendors will have to register, otherwise they will be non-compliant. And we welcome the consultation that is being opened by National Treasury, but we do think an effective date of 1 October 2018 will put us in a very difficult position where we might not have been able to sort these things out by way of consultation before the systems have to be put in place to implement by the effective date. On that note, I hand over to my level who will talk about the implementation of the date.
Thanks, Erica. So now that we're in, we're within the period after the VAT increase that happened, it's important that we, you know, take the time to reflect on what happened up until this point now that we're within it. And it's become very clear that from the date in which it was announced to the date it became effective, that not enough time was given for the period of 38 days. And what we're seeing in practice is that a lot of businesses obviously didn't have their systems set up, you know, for the 15% given hadn't been changed in so long. So a lot of businesses therefore had to make changes to their systems. The example where large businesses had to update as many as 47 of these systems just to make sure that they were within the 15%. There are other instances as well where customers or taxpayers who don't update their own software had to rely obviously on external IT specialists to come in and update the software for them. And then there are some instances where manual workarounds were required, where they would have to be apportioned between the 14 and the 15%, depending on where you go in. And I think with taking, you know, everything that's happened up until this point now, it's very clear that not enough time was given in order for businesses and taxpayers to really be ready for when this effective change came to be. Now, some of the other issues that we've seen in practice are just some transitional issues. And by transitional issues, I speak to when taxpayers have to figure out when to apply the 14% or the 15%. And the mechanisms within the Act can be a little complicated to apply. So goods and services are obviously treated slightly different. For services, for example, if the services were started before the change in the percentage rate and then they were concluded, let's say, after, if the Act tells us that the rate would have to be apportioned, so you'd have to apportion some of the services in 14% and the rest in 15%, and it speaks to a fair and reasonable apportionment. Now, as of now, there is no guideline to what fair and reasonable apportionment actually means. It also meant that anti-avoidance rule and tracking issues would obviously have to be, in terms of time and supply, sorry, would have to be tracked more closely because goods would obviously be treated slightly differently. So the anti-avoidance rule basically say that if the time of supply was before the rate change and the goods were supplied 21 days after the effective date, so 22nd of April, you would fall within the 15%. But if the goods were supplied within the 21 days, so before the 22nd of April, you'd be within 14%. So it's just some of the challenges that we're seeing with some of our members in practice, you know, just the complexity of trying to apply when to use the 14% and when to use the 15% and some of the challenges there. And what we're basically saying is that taxpayers want to be compliant and they want to make sure that their tax affairs are in order and that they're doing things correctly. But with some of the technicalities and issues that we're seeing within the Act, it's easy or it can be expected to a certain degree that, you know, errors will be made by the taxpayer, you know, because of some of the complexities. And in these instances, the taxpayers would like the opportunity to be able to correct their errors without being subject to any penalties and interest. So the request is really for there to be enabling legislation so that in instances such as this, SARB would have leniency on the taxpayer and waive some of the interest and penalties in instances, obviously, where they've seen... just in instances, obviously, where SARB can also see that a genuine mistake has been made by the taxpayer and give them the chance to rectify their error and just give them a bit of leniency in that regard.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you to SITE and to PwC, all the members. And then OTA and then SACRA.
Revenue, because we're sitting in a revenue shortfall position. But what is also important is that we don't want to lose revenue. We
where's the revenue that we collect, we don't want to actually give it away. And what this means is that when we're looking at a potential loss of revenue, if you've got a foreign business who's going to register for VAT, who's going to charge the VAT on the supply, and who's going to be very naughty and not pay it over, what that actually means is that the person who's in South Africa and has been charged that VAT can actually still go and deduct the VAT. So what you mean is that the result is that actually there's a loss of revenue from the FIS because the VAT has been claimed back from the FIS, but no VAT has been put in to recover that VAT that has been claimed. So this is a problem that has been sitting there that we are facing when we are talking about businesses that are being required to register. Also what is impacted on multinational group companies. There's one entity that I know in my work with the OECD that they've got 6,000 charges that go around into the group around the world. What this means is that they've got to effect registration for all these different group entities to account for VAT and for the South African entity to claim the VAT, which means a net zero gain of SARS. But if you think of the administrative implications of that and the cost of doing business by requiring these entities to register, it then starts making the question, why do you actually want to do this? Also, what is happening, and again this is a global thing, is non-resident small businesses. Because the threshold is so low, i.e. 50,000 rand, when your non-resident small businesses are supplying services into South Africa, they're going to reach that 50,000 rand threshold very quickly. They, however, can't afford to comply with the South African legislation. And again, you think, what is the revenue gain of such a small So when we look at, interestingly enough, the Data Tax Committee report came out after the vote. And when you look at what the Data Tax Committee report is saying on this particular topic, is exactly what the legislation does not contain. So it's saying there should be a B2B, B2C distinction, as what our colleagues previously were talking about. There is no such distinction. There is no concession on the issue of tax invoices. So foreign businesses are required to actually go and change their systems, which is not required internationally. They're required to go and change their systems to make sure the tax invoices are issued. The registration threshold of 50,000 rand is also not being considered. As proposed by the Data Tax Committee, that it should be increased. And again, there's a payment basis of SARS, which they are using as a method of accounting for VAT, and all businesses don't account for VAT and basically account for it on the invoice basis. So therefore, it's really at odds with what the Data Tax Committee has said. It's also at odds with what the international community and international business and international governments have implemented with regard to this. So the problem is that we are facing is that the inherent non-compliance is going to happen.
Thank you, Leslie. What we have attempted to highlight are the issues that we've discussed with our clients. We've had a few webinars with global clients in terms of the concerns that they have about this. And in our view, there's still a significant amount of work that has to happen before this legislation can in fact be implemented. And we would really request that there is proper public consultation as far as that is concerned. We are aware of the workshop on the 25th of May, and we will attend that, and we'll attempt to get some of our clients to attend that as well, that we can actually explain the technicalities of as far as that's concerned. But just to highlight the issues that we believe that are important, while we understand that the layout of the legislation is such that there's no business-to-business and business-to-consumer distinction, and in South Africa we're just subject back to all supply. From a global perspective and for global companies, it's very difficult to try and have a different system that is different to the OECD in this particular space and different to the systems that they apply across the world. So that would be a very high priority as far as we're concerned. The second aspect is around the broad definition, and I think that the previous regulations, while they were quite limited, were very effective, and the results of that and the companies that came and registered proved that was a successful outing. But what has happened now is that it's just simply too long. I mean, that definition is too broad, and there needs to be much more clarity as far as that's concerned. I mean, we would also ask that there's an adequate time for the implementation of the laws in fact being promulgated and that there's certainty as far as that's concerned. I mean, I think the most recent one that is implemented is New Zealand, and they've allowed a 15-month period from the time that the law was final before the implication, before the the regulations or the changes in fact came into effect. We believe that it is critical that we have this public consultation, that we have certainty in terms of what is in and what is out, and that there's been a proper, a reasonable period as far as that's concerned. And I think that brings us to the point that we do not believe that 1 October this year is feasible. At this point in time, we believe that there's a lot of work that still needs to happen as part of the public consultation, as part of the legislation. So simply to announce in draft legislation and in the budget that 1 October, when it's going to happen, it is simply not possible for international companies to comply with. The next step, and this is the way that we believe that it should be resolved, is that there must be this consultation because of the significant impact that it has. We'd be happy to engage in that particular space to get clarity on these items, but the date needs to be delayed, and we need to have a fixed timeline in terms of the first phase, which is getting to finality in terms of what the rules are, and then a reasonable period to allow international companies to comply and to amend their systems and to register in South Africa's VAT vendors as required. That concludes our submission on the electronic services. We also thought we would just take the opportunity to speak very briefly about the impact of the increase in the VAT rates on the 1st of April. And I do want to emphasize that we fully support the increase. Is something that we think from an economic perspective should have happened previously, because we thought there was scope to do that. We understand the challenges that have been presented to the committee this morning. And the context of making these comments is to think about future VAT increases and to simplify the processing administration that happened at that particular point in time. What I've been trying to do is to draw up a report card based on the success of the VAT implementation, increase in rates, and what was required in the circumstances. And without getting into the noises to the difference between the bill of the 21st of February and the bill of the, or draft bill of the 8th of March, we would give National Treasury 20% in terms of what was published in that bill. The VAT rate is of 14% was included in five places in the legislation, and there was only one that was amended. So one out of five is what was correct in those circumstances. Trying to sit down and think about what the impact was and how good SARS was at its implementation, and I must admit it's very difficult for us to come up with a percentage, especially in terms of their mandate and in terms of what they're supposed to achieve. I mean, the first thing that happened is there was very little engagement with business, which I think is part of what they're required to do. The second thing was that there were no rulings that were issued. The concession to that was a number of frequently asked questions that were published and updated on a regular basis, none of which had binding effect on SARS whatsoever. And then there was one system at SARS that needed to be changed, and that was to amend the VAT return in comparison to business that had from one system to one example where there were 80 different systems that needed to be changed, and SARS needed on the VAT return to introduce different fields to account for the different rates, and because of the costs and the hassles in terms of doing that, a decision has been taken that they will stick with the original form and will change the rules in terms of implementing the form. Now, from a timing perspective, I mean, I would assume that SARS and National Treasury was aware of the fact before the 21st of February that the rate was coming, rate increase was coming. The VAT return also only had to come effective 30 days after the effective date, whereas business had 25 business days to have a fully fledged system operational, and in fact no leniency, and as confirmed in readings to a number of industry groups, in the sense that if vendors make errors in the circumstances, they have an option. They can follow the voluntary disclosure process, but have one bite of that cherry to say we messed up the VAT rate increase, and if a month later they discover another one, then they will no longer qualify for the voluntary disclosure. Secondly, in terms of the remission of 10% late payment penalties, in terms of the Tax Administration Act, there's a first incidence and that applies for a 3-year period. So somebody whose accountant was run over by a bus in February and used that first incidence provision, but also couldn't amend its 80 systems to go live on the 1st of April, could in fact not qualify for the remission of the 10% penalty under those circumstances. Now, we believe that is problematic, that there's an expectation that business should have complied 100%. We don't believe that that's possible in the circumstances. And our recommendation would be, and I've done some research of this internationally, the firm's consensus around the world is that we need at least a 12-month warning period from the date that the increase in rate is announced until it actually goes live. I mean, there have been instances, the UK, the period is typically 6 months. In other places, it's 3 to 4 months. There's a good example in Germany where, in fact, informing people about the rate increase resulted in increased economic activity because people went out and bought cars and luxury goods prior to the rate increase, so in fact saw that result in that. So I think that unfortunately we're in the position, and this will come into play in the next few weeks as businesses start closing down their systems for the month to see how accurate their numbers are and what needs to be submitted to SARS. But we would really request that in future there's adequate planning, there's more public consultation, and there's more certainty and timing to plan for that rate increase. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you to PwC, other members. There's a new angle to this topic. Very interesting. Thank you. Ota?
Yes. Mr. Manotua, tell us why she was smiling so warmly at PwC, the speaker. Deficit remains despite a predicted increase in tax revenue.
increase in expenditure is also proposed, and of course this is necessary in certain areas and certain levels of government. Increased expenditure, infrastructure, etc. is necessary and good. But public administration has not improved in past years despite additional allocation. And this perpetuates a flawed precedent. In general, lack of bureaucratic capacity is not necessarily a result of underfunding. Thinking, for example, of the road accident fund and the fuel levy that's going to contribute to the financial situation. I mean, they are virtually bankrupt. And additional allocations might keep them afloat for the time being, but more human-orientated and practically-orientated interventions might be preferable. Once again, administrative capacity is extremely important, especially considering the fact that the virtue of these amendments and increases in tax revenue is based on tax compliance, on effective tax collection, and basically the avoidance of tax avoidance. We believe that taxation should not increase perpetually. If the requisite enhancement of public sector performance and public-private partnerships is realized, consistent increases will not be necessary. Increasing taxes proportionally increases public demand for governmental accountability. This is fundamentally our philosophy. The more dependent government is on the fiscus, the greater the onus on it to improve its performance and service ordinary citizens. And in past years, this has not been the case. It's actually been the opposite. So I'll speak to individual amendments. We understand the need for the consideration of a estate duty tax increase because it is not progressive, and it can be perceived as a progressive form, but it can also incentivize capital flight if not carefully considered. And the feasibility of this also depends on the bureaucratic efficiency of the master's office, the tax ombud, SARS, and so on. These are lacking. Various smaller financial institutions are having serious problems with the administration of estate duties and these kinds of funds. So a lack of an effective government response to serious and far-reaching allegations of corruption, maladministration and poor governance has undermined the social contract between taxpayers, independent financial service providers and these institutions. And we recognize that government is taking steps to address this and that it's not something that's not known, but it should be fundamentally considered when considering these increases year on year. Measures must be put in place to monitor compliance and ensure that estate duty tax is not avoided, as it has been in the past to a significant degree. And we believe that a serious consideration of a robust wealth tax would be more effective in contributing to the fiscus while addressing injustices of the past. And this is also because it would be administratively simpler. The consistent expansion and categorization of certain amounts that must be taxed at a certain rate is burdensome. And this will add to the problem of bureaucratic inefficiency that already exists in various institutions. We do not support the increase in value-added tax as it stands, because the deficit has been caused by maladministration, wasteful expenditure, corruption, and even state capture, which is basically the pinnacle of all. And this is the fundamental qualitative question that we are asking, is should ordinary citizens pay for government failures? This is rhetorical, but what is the alternative? And we believe that it would be really good to have a platform where completely different alternatives can be considered. For example, the panel that is now going to consider the zero-rated items in National Treasury. It would be good if a similar platform, and they are going to provide opportunity for public participation, but a similar platform in which completely different approaches to the consistent deficit can be proposed and considered and researched in depth with various stakeholders participating. And this sounds like a hearsay perspective, but the Minister of Economic Development recently reiterated a comment he made in October last year that a end was done by the Industrial Development Corporation to make an estimation of what corruption actually costs the country and what additional revenue there would be available in circulation if corruption was completely eradicated. And his estimation was, well, based on a 10% increase in the price of infrastructure projects, which is a modest estimation, would be 27 billion rand and 76,000 jobs. Increased value-added tax exacerbates the plight of the poor in its current form. We acknowledge that there's going to be an opportunity to participate in National Treasury's reconsideration of the zero-rated items list, but as it stands, we do not agree. Another reason why this is problematic is, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, overall, the performance of that system depends on three main factors, and this is very straightforward. The degree of compliance by taxpayers, which is problematic in the context of governmental underperformance, the structural features of tax, rates, exemptions, thresholds, and the capacity of the tax administration to manage the system in an efficient way. And these are fundamental principles that are necessary to make that achieve its intended goal of increase. And we are lacking in these capacities in our government. National Treasury contends that the additional revenue sourced from the fiscus through the increase in value-added tax would largely be contributed by higher individuals and intent to consume. And this makes sense in theory. General stakeholders conversely contend that this is fundamentally regressive and that the range of zero-rated food items should be expanded. We recommend that a country be better informed of how exactly this increase is going to benefit poor people. That should be the intention, we believe it is the intention, to increase social welfare expenditure, to increase public sector expenditure that is beneficial to the impoverished people of our society. But people do not necessarily understand this. So there is a platform that was recently created between various sort of society entities and the National Treasury called Imaniyetu, which means our money. Basically, this gives a simple indication of how tax money is collected, what proportion, what type of tax, where does it go, how is it spent. And this is a good example of what we propose. The Davis Tax Committee states that at best, it may be appropriate to consider only retaining those items that more clearly benefit people, such as maize, milk, rice, and vegetables, or withdrawing those items more clearly consumed by more affluent households, such as food and more. National Treasury has indicated that it wants to take extensive feasibility studies, and one can argue that there's too little to do. Nevertheless, we do intend to participate in that opportunity. Furthermore, multiple roads for certain goods and services further increases the administrative complexity of taxation. As I said, exacerbates existing bureaucratic problems. Another argument that's put in favour of the increase in that is the fact that it doesn't decrease production efficiency and employment. In fact, the direct taxation, such as corporate income tax and personal income tax, might negatively impact these parameters. But this is simply because commercial entities deflect these additional costs through downscaling capital flight, price adjustments, and retrenchment, preserving their profitability. In sum, businesses tend to offload the burden of that on the final consumers and workers. So we recommend the legislature and particularly standing and select committees on finance in collaboration with National Treasury provide a platform in which tax policy can be fundamentally reconsidered. And I've heard a few people have actually indicated this recommendation, and it would be good to have this kind of platform to really consider alternative paths. As it stands and in the situation we are in, the very straightforward amendments that are proposed with which we can engage, but it's quite limiting. I believe that if various stakeholders are given the opportunity, we could really propose complete shifts in the manner in which government raises money and spends it. This aligns with the intention of the impending parliamentary proceedings and report of the High Level Panel on the assessment of key legislation and acceleration of fundamental change. I mean, this is something that's going to become adopted soon, and we intend to participate in that as well. I mean, this plays into the broader particularity of the current political landscape. It's a good opportunity to really bring about change. Increases in taxation in the past 10 years have not really resulted in improvements in government. It hasn't resulted in a decrease in unemployment. And these are fundamental problems that need to be addressed. I have to understand that VAT is a relatively neutral and fair taxing theory, as I said, but as it stands, it does have a negative impact on poor people and on working classes, and it is not justified in the context of persistent corruption, maladministration, and financial mismanagement. We believe that there are still various issues and inadequacies in government that need to be addressed. These things have come to light in recent years, but there's still a long way to go. Despite the aforementioned shortcomings, we will participate in the National Treasury's hearings on the expansion or change of the zero rate item list. So finally on that, poverty and inequality should be eradicated by aggressively facilitating employment, alternative industrialization, and sustainable economic growth. Taxation shouldn't always be the reflexive mechanism that we use when economic growth is not adequate, when the deficit is consistently increasing. The manner in which money is spent is more important in our view, as opposed to how it is collected. Indirect taxation that does not worsen the plight of the poor could be an effective means of incurring the tax revenue without undermining productivity, job creation, and economic growth, but that's not yet the case. Finally, the dichotomization between increased indirect taxation and productivity must be deconstructed, but that dichotomy doesn't exist at the moment. With regards to customs and excise duties, we hold that the increase is overly simplistic and that does not adequately address the budget deficit or socioeconomic problems, but it is essentially a luxury tax which consumers can choose to avoid if they do not consume these kinds of products. Circumstances which I've alluded to, the primary contributor to reduced deficit should be increased efficiency of public sector expenditure as opposed to increased indirect taxation. The goal of inclusive economic growth is ultimately to increase the amount of taxpayers in every bracket. That's what Sally and I were speaking about last time I was here. And this, we believe, will improve government's ability to alleviate poverty through public expenditure. As opposed to increasing the rate per se of individual income tax brackets, it would be better to try to increase the number of taxpayers in all brackets. So unbridled fiscal control of economic dynamics can catalyze corruption, maladministration, nepotism, and even state capture. This might sound radical, but it's become evident that certain pieces of legislation, certain members have alluded to the fact that certain pieces of legislation can actually be exploited, can be more harmful than beneficial to society, and we've seen this in the form of fronting and other forms of legislative exploitation. Poverty, inequality, and unemployment are fundamental problems that must be addressed. What is the best way to do this? So we're consistently discussing conventional avenues to address these issues, but change is rare. This is a problem. Aggressive investment in alternative industrialization and socio-technical regime change can increase employment rates. I mean, this is what happened in the Southeast Asian nations in the 80s. They completely changed the manner in which government was spending money. They forced industrialization and created employment. this in turn will increase the amount of tax revenue without increasing the rates of the state. We urge National Treasury not to consider any additional increases in personal income tax going forward, since this has been increased consistently despite a lack of improvement. As I said earlier, it would be better, and we believe that it would be good to consider a wealth tax as opposed to this, and as opposed to a state duty tax increase. But this needs to be discussed, and this has not been discussed properly. And this is a very new idea. The establishment of a taxpayer bill of rights is something that we completely support, including mechanisms that protect taxpayers from predatory state behavior and poor governance in general. Financially based punitive measures for poor public sector performance under the leadership of incumbent political parties should be considered to incentivize improvement in self-discipline. I mean, at the moment, as things are, it's taxpayers and citizens who bear the brunt of poor government performance, and what determines a political party's ability to govern is the amount of votes it gets, and this is influenced by campaigning as opposed to necessarily being incentivized by good performance. When I say this, I mean, for example, deductions from political party funding, that's now been formalized, that's become public and transparent. Can poor financial performance of the incumbent political parties, whomever they may be at whichever time, not be punished in this way? This is a dialogue that we should have. And we strongly recommend the tax policy be strategically revised to allow for institutional innovation and alternative systems of financial dispensation given the range of failures in governance in recent years. This can't be accommodated. Various stakeholders would like to be interested in such a undertaking, such an opportunity. Again, we believe that government should prepare for zero tax increases in the next fiscal year if it is committed to eradicating financial liability of corruption, nepotism, and maladministration. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. One of your slides is not numbered. The scope of this public hearing does not really allow for a radical, unorthodox recommendation. We invite you to do it. That's why Parliament is here, having public hearings. Raise your voice, let your voice be heard. So make use of that opportunity. Thank you for your presentation, honourable members. We're going straight to the South African Constitutional Property Rights Foundation. Here's a colourful picture on page one.
This is always in the last one.
I know you for thousands of years. Now, my eyesight's not very good, so I didn't know who you were to come together.
Sorry?
I didn't know who was. I can't see very well, so I didn't know this was you. But can we agree that next time Mr. Meekin is here, we put him up front?
Okay.
What we do is cluster. So we take trade unions, NGOs, and then we take individuals and, PwC. But we could have had you first one. I think in fairness we can do that.
Okay,
sure. I know Mr. Meekin from the property of Lake Smoke, where he sat through late into the night. He was more there than some of the members of Parliament, mainly a certain party. You were not around. 2004. And he writes to me endlessly, and he gives books for me to read and so on. And I didn't know, actually, to be honest. I browse through them, I read the blurb and so on. I read. I work 14 to 16 hours a day. There's so much I can do at normal. And this is an area of enormous conflict. Okay. This is your expertise. Now, we have a brilliant team. There's Takela Shope, Antonia Manuela, and we also got support from the very good staff in the parliamentary body. They help us. But I do read your and I can predict what you're going to say, but I'll not say what. I can summarize for you what you're going to say, but I won't. Did you write a letter to the Business Day one? Or that you would have left.
I write every day.
Yes, somebody who said that I summarized even better than he could his argument on the property suite. Except sadly, the chairperson opposed what I said.
I don't know if it was you.
Yeah, somebody here.
Chairman, if I may just on a point of information, ask Mr. Meekin whether this is, and is he trying to sell his house at Bantry Bay?
The house on the red roof. Please take note. It looks much like Amsterdam.
Excuse me. The answer to that is, if you didn't tax my work and my capital,
you wouldn't have to.
No. Exactly. I wouldn't sell it.
excuse my wife. I didn't hear that one. I can see here the scriptural relationship. We admire that. You're welcome to the
I can't overlook an opportunity here, sir, to just respond to Judge Davis this morning, with whom I don't agree with anything. But let me just say that he's not as clever as he sounds. I'll tell you why. In explaining taxation to him, his father did not eat the judge's ice cream.
Mr. Chair, we're not going to listen to this type of thing. No.
He does not understand.
He doesn't respond for himself, so I'm not interested in how this part.
The judge is not here to say anything on what you are saying now, so I think you must refrain from that. Let's go to the business of the meeting.
Let me just think this through. All right. That landowners don't pay tax. We hand over some money to SARS on the right day, and then we wait for the land prices to increase, which they invariably do. So we're not payers of tax, we just lend money out, and the state reimburses us with higher land prices. This is a problem, and it is a refusal to understand that in nature there is no room for poverty. If I had a 30 square meter plot and I spent an hour a day on it, I'd grow all the vegetables and fruit, you know this, you're a farmer. I'd grow all the vegetables and fruit for my family. If I spent 5 hours a day, I'd need to be 150 square meters, which is still tiny. I'd grow food for four other families. And that's, I can make through that quite a lot more money than an average wage. A lot of people have not read section 228 of this constitution, and have you, sir, recently?
I went to the constitution daily.
Well, let me just, it's terribly important, if you don't mind me saying it that way. But it says, okay, it's talking about provincial taxes, but it really means all taxes, municipal or national. It says that the legislature may not impose taxes. May not be exercised in a way that materially and unreasonably prejudices national economic policies. So, We cannot tax people's work and their capital, because in doing so we raise the price of everything.
When you tax labor, you raise the size of the price of hiring. When you tax capital, you raise the size of capital. When you tax goods, the goods go up. When you tax services, the services go up. When you tax land, the land price, and the land price goes up. Now, this is a mad way. But to explain it, it's been, I find, terribly difficult, and particularly with Treasury. Now, Mr. Kearns, I think you remember the last time we were here, you instructed them to meet with us and report back to you on exactly what we were trying to do. Well, we put a lot of effort into that. I brought out a senior professor of economics. He's head of the Department of Economics at Virginia University, and we had five or six other people, and we went to Victoria. We sat with them for a good 2 hours, gave a full presentation, and we haven't heard anything back from them. I phoned Mr. Axelson 2 weeks ago, and I said, "Well, have you found out? Have you got a report from Mr. Karim to say how you're getting on with this, with understanding what we're doing?" And he says, "No." I'll tell you what he said. And I'm sure he's right. He said he had not completed the report. He said it was a policy matter and was taking time. But as a matter of interest, as I explained to him, this is not a policy matter. This matter has been decided in the Constitution. The Constitution puts the policy. It says you must not you must not prejudice economic activities. Now, I think this is a suggestion I make rather reservedly, but I do think that our system, the reason why we're not getting a response from Treasury, and the reason why other people here have not got the response from Treasury, is that they are in unison with the professional tax, with the tax professionals in this country, not to deviate from the status quo. Now, there's a good reason for that. And valuation, as a value, I'm under revision, which is dying, and their profession will die if we move from income taxes to land taxes. There'll be no need for these meetings. We'll have lots more time for cooking. So let me just try and explain this using a land sale in Clifton Bungalow, which was sold for 25 million rand in 2018. It was to be demolished. It's vacant land. Now that land will attract 1.6 million rent. That's the rates and taxes surcharge, it's a user charge, at the classical 16-year multiple. In other words, you pay 25 million rand for it, but over 16 years you don't have to pay anything more. So you get it for life, you get it in perpetuity, and you pay 16 years. Now that's the problem of equity, as far as I'm concerned. And now, this is upside down, so extending this across South Africa are 126 million hectares of land are worth 16.5 trillion rand and will rent for 1 trillion annually. Now, I want to be quite sure about that 16.5 trillion rand. It did not come about because of any activity or investment by the owner other than the first 15 years rent. That is a complete windfall. It's wonderful, but I tell you what, it's only wonderful for landowners. The landlords are not participating in that
in that value. You see, that rental, that 1 trillion rand rent from the entire South Africa, that is the same as the taxes are today. You could get the same taxes today from a land as you can from income taxes and VAT. In fact, you can get more from land, because once you reduce, you know, that 1 trillion rand is worked out on the basis we're all being taxed as we are today. Once you take those taxes away, it means you'll get more taxes in, because there'll be more rents, there'll be more activity, everything will be tax-free, everything that you would pay into the tax fund. And what's more, it takes up that 1.6 trillion rand. Sorry, I've got the figure wrong. That 1.1 trillion rand is 25% of GDP. So it reduces GDP as well. I mean, what are we doing here? These are then viewed as deadweight taxes. Income taxes and VAT are deadweight. So they eat at our economy. They make poverty. They make land more expensive, unaffordable, because the land increases if you don't tax it. Now, for comparison, Singapore and Hong Kong rely more on what I call the commonwealth of land. That's the rental. When we build the bridges, when we put the infrastructure in, when we put the roads in, when we provide services, that is adding value to the land. And in Singapore and Hong Kong, they capture that. Most of that value they capture, so that their income taxes and VAT are lowered significantly. And this encourages investment and makes land affordable and increases wages and shortens the employment queues. Now, neither the Katz Commission nor the Dennis Tax Committee have understood this. I've tried my hardest with Judge Davis. I've had board people in here to speak to him. I tried with the Katz Commission. They will not listen. They were both briefed on the alternative land rent system, but opted for the status quo of punishing people for working. You're sitting here, you're being punished. You're working and they're taking half your salary. You see that? It's a punishment. You work and they take half of what you earn. The same with profits. Now, this was in apparent ignorance of the fact that the only victims of a land rent regime are owners of unused land, the speculators. And that is true. You can have this piece of land is vacant, it's sold for 24 million rand. It just comes in. The more you tax people on their capital and their labor, the more the rents go up and the prices go up. But Mrs. Tax and Davis are not naive. They knew then and know now that ending income taxes and VAT will end the tax profession. And in putting their signatures to their reports without disclosing their conflict of personal interest is punishable. It's a crime to do that. So after their meeting, ending taxes means halting the expropriation of hard-earned fruits of citizens' work and man-made wealth without compensation. That's what they're trying to do with land now. But what's been going on in Texas is that's exactly what they've been doing. They daily expropriate our wages, our salaries, our capital, our interest, our profits, and that floods 228. I want to just read two examples. People have written books about this, but the Katz Commission said in one in excuse me, in its introduction, the Commission recognises that economic stability cannot be promoted through attempts to shift the tax burden predominantly onto any single dimension of economic activity. Well, it might have recognised that, but that's wrong. If you only tax land, your GDP will grow. You won't have any landers, and you won't have any people without jobs. The Davis Tax Commission, just to say what they said. They might not be able to answer, but this is what they said. The tax system must not be used to offset pathologies in other parts of the system in respect of property rights or labour market challenges. But this ignores the fact that these taxes are the underlying cause of the problems in the property market, where it's too expensive for people to enter. And because they subsidize land prices, that's what you're doing in this chamber. You're seeing how much further you can subsidize land prices. And that is in direct contradiction with Section 25.5. And the labor market is constrained if jobs are confined to wage contracts. The alternative is to rely on nature. I rest my case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meekin, for your views. I sometimes drive there. Interesting, when they build houses, they build it with cranes. That's the only way you can get bricks to the site where you want to build a house. You must hire a crane. Yeah. That's another part of South Africa. And we've got a responsibility, Mr. Meekin. We represent people as we sit here, from different political parties, and it's a huge responsibility. But thank you for your inputs. Honourable members, questions, and I will reply in the order of the presentations made. Honourable Tandy. Anyone else? Else? Okay. Next.
Chair, I'm going to subject myself to the presentation of Salich and PwC. I'm less perplexed by the presentation because I'm more confused after these two presentations. And not that I don't understand digital economy or whatsoever. You see, these two companies speak as if digital payments are only going to be made for the first time now that VAT is going to increase to 15%. As if in the current conjuncture it does not take place. And I'm going to make an example of what I'm trying to say. You see, PW says that in terms of the tools that SARS have in place, if you increase VAT to 15%, it's going to be a cumbersome process. Now here we're discussing 1% increase, not the tools that SARS are having in place. If they need to be changed just in terms of the tools that SARS are having in place, different debate for a different day altogether. So we need to be able to separate issues that are under discussion today. Secondly, we're made to believe that if you make a transaction today, it's incomplete. I don't understand. A transaction becomes complete when payment is made. So whether payment is made 7 days down the line, that's when the transaction becomes complete. So if VAT applies 3 days in between the transaction not being completed, then it's between the supplier and the receiver that need to sort out their problems of how they transact in between. Here we're talking about the application of the law. So the law cannot be seen as punitive because transactions between two parties have not been made to finish on time. So it can be an issue for discussion in this case. So we can't claim that services are overlapping. It cannot be a service until the transaction has been concluded. In relation to international companies, there are companies who are incorporated and listed in South Africa, therefore they will pay tax in South Africa. once they're incorporated and listed somewhere a little bit, they're not within our tax jurisdiction. So we're not confused about what we're doing. Very clear what we're doing. So it's unfortunate that you create this deliberate confusion that when companies are jurisdiction in listing and incorporation is different, then they're supposed to pay tax in South Africa. You need to clear yourself in terms of how you understand. The Tax Administration Act, if you need to make changes in it, we propose us that we can deal with the AI that's different. Here we're talking about the tax increase, not the contents of the Tax Administration Act as it stands. And the definitions that you find in the Tax Administration Act. So Chair, I'm very disillusioned. I'm participating in a very disillusioned manner in which the presentations have been made to create an impression. You see, if you're traveling abroad, you don't pay tax where you are visiting. You're going to pay tax on commodities as you bring them to the shores of South Africa. So that company that sold you a piece of item there is not responsible for the administration of the tax as it comes to the commodity that you bring in the shores of South Africa. That's what happens. So I suggest, Poyanga and Chris, you need to explain in totality because it seems as if in relation to, well, when there's one issue that Saeed raises which you might want to consider is the issue of when you're buying a commodity on the internet and the tool doesn't give you an option to pay tax in the immediate and claim refund based on how you deal with internet transactions as SAR. Maybe it's an issue we might want to consider and look at it and see how it has happened. She made an example with Amazon and Ghana and how we have been collecting taxes based on those e-transactions that are taking place. But if somebody sources whether a legal opinion abroad and so on, it's neither here nor there in terms of the discussions and the arguments that has been advanced, I think.
Or release.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just with to Erica and perhaps others as well, but the question of VAT on retention, maybe actually National Treasury, have you had clients asking you about, you do a building, VAT's 14%, but the retention is only paid out later, and then the VAT rate has now changed in the interim. Are there any implications here? I had a query last night about it, and I couldn't think my way through it clearly. So, maybe you or anyone else. Thanks, Gary. I wasn't here for the whole of PwC, your presentation, but just some clarity with regard to your enthusiasm for a VAT increase. I assume that is on the premise that any increase in taxes at all is required. And maybe I missed that, but I would be surprised if it wasn't, so that would be my question there. So Mr. Chairman, my apologies, Joint Chairs, for not being able to be here earlier, but it's good to be here now.
You're welcome. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just very shortly, for the benefit of the committee and for the last presenter, Section 228 of the Constitution applies specifically to provincial taxes. That's the way the Constitution is set up, that you have your central powers, which are not enumerated, and you have provincial powers that are limited and enumerated, and they've got very limited taxation powers, less than local government. So when you read 228, it applies only to provincial taxes. It doesn't apply to national taxes. In other words, it doesn't apply to the Bowie Union. That's my view, just from what I heard from the Bowie Union. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for that legal opinion and clarity. Or Dr. Lim?
I think it also applies to real estate property rates. You cannot, into
personal property links that undermine national economic
Thank you. Any other questions? None? You may move? Who? Peggy. Well, sorry.
Okay.
I didn't see your hand, sorry.
I'm sorry, Chair. No, I'm covered. I was going to pose my question on with regard to electronic economy, but comments and you covered me, so thank you.
You covered.
I don't know
who's saying
COVID. Okay. Yeah, explain to you. Basically, look, firstly, the same issue that Tandy raised also struck me. What is fundamentally new? Just the VAT is increasing, right? You'll explain, I don't understand. Secondly, there is a question raised about whether the 1st of October is a feasible deadline. I think you should be responsible. You know, they said, it doesn't mean, therefore, we should follow the route, you know, New Zealand and like Australia to 59. But in many senses, we are frankly a more sophisticated country than very many developed countries. I heard this morning for the first time, hands up those of you who knew, and it's Judge Dennis Davis Nahal saying that our VAT system is regarded as the world's most efficient thing. Will the opposition parties at least acknowledge that? It's something to be proud of. It's our country. Never mind who's running it. It's something to be proud of. Right? That not that I approve of the 1% increase necessarily, but its efficiency, you know. And despite the challenges filed with that, presumably that has not been, let's say, lightened, so we still remain number one in the world. Instead of being 15 out of 10, we may be 12 out of 10, right? But we're still ahead of the United States, Trump and him. And who was quoting May? You guys love but May and so on. And China, well, I don't know what China does, and everywhere else. The small, middle-income, middle-level developing country, run by a party that was in the bushes until 1994, right? It was up to 1994, in my province, in Albanese's province, in Zakele's province, there was a civil war going on in the townships, right? ISP versus UDF stroke ANC, right? So, it's really something. Never mind whether I agree with the 1% increase or what I think of VAT. I'm talking about efficiency, something to be proud of, right? A lot of other things. I'm sorry, I sounded like an imbongi for the ANC. I'm not just put together back on the list of 63. I'm trying to think of I keep saying 63. I don't know why, because I calculated 2019, taking out the 63. So my doctor reminded me, I'm saying that up, you're 62. Okay. But I did get an E for arithmetic or math, whatever it was, in mistake. Now, the thing is also, I don't want to hear that gentleman, right? But you, Mr. Meeting, it's not about me. If I say something as a chair or so does Charles, the members can say, no, we don't agree with you. So when they don't, you take it to committee. You're not doing it for me, National Treasury. It's not a personal thing. But I want to say this from my personal side, now, not on behalf of the committee, I have no mandate. But you know what? I respect you for your resilience, your determination, your unrelenting nature. And at your age, to doggedly come to this parliament, time and again. Think of me, I'm a Marxist. Right? Age 16, I became 17. Well, 16, baby, I became a Marxist. Right? Yeah. No, my brother, listen to me. No. In the year 2018, I remain a Marxist, though a more moderate and temperate one, right? So you and I share something in common, right? There may be others who say they're National Democrats even now, notwithstanding the playing in the edges of the National Democratic Project. So in that sense, we have our own common resilience. Okay?
Yes, that's
Marx agreed with Adam. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. You said that before. Now, I want to tell you something else. If it's of any value, right? I went to the Land Only Policy Institute. No. Look, my sister, listen to me, right? I know your argument also because Sydney Mufamadi didn't trust the committee, right? So he arranged for the chairs to go. We determined the program, Peggy. He said, no, I want you guys to go to Georgetown University. And then he took us to a place that you're your brethren, so to speak, at the Land Only Institute, right? I went there. I know which one. We spent a whole day there. We argued simply that we should have only land taxes, right? Not on property as well. Your argument, right? But if the decision was taken by the community, Chris, in theory it is, because nobody disagrees. It's about respect for people, right? Whether they come, I'm not implying you now, whether they come from the extreme right or extreme left, right? extreme right or extreme left, this is their parliament, right? And the great thing about this National Democratic Party is precisely that. People must come to this parliament. That's why the, what's this people, the Constantinople and Kenya, right? They could have unleashed, I keep raising this thing, the sections of the right-wing army, and they didn't. And which is cheap, in Kosovo, they came in here finally. This is the wonder of this democracy. And those of us who are on our way out, you would like to protest. So no matter what we think of his views, we have to reply to him. Also, he's an elderly person, but he's no less South African than anybody else. Never mind whether they believe him. So can you reply about where things are? You see, it's not fair for this gentleman to come repeatedly and make the same point. But he, like me, will continue to come and make one's point. But never mind what people say. It's the right of people to speak. They must change the rules. I'm never going to, while I'm chair, you know, allow that to happen. Right? People must speak their mind, whatever it is. So what I'm saying is, in fairness to him, he must get a reply. He can't carry on. But you are, he's right to say it's a policy matter. But then you must give him a policy reply. It's a simple thing. Refer it to the deputy minister or the minister who is dealing with taxes mainly. The DG must find, well, like I call it, give us a copy, even if it's a two-pager. You're not going to agree with him. I have no doubt. I don't agree with him, but I hear him, and I do read more of his stuff than he's making out or made up. I do, actually, now and then. But I don't agree with him. He knows that. But I understand his thinking. And let's be fair. Like everybody else, we've done this before for other people, right? We say, people cannot keep coming here and making the same point without Trey's reply. So can we ask you for a reply, and can we have a timeline, and can we have a report, a reply? But I want to tell you one final thing. I don't know if you were there this morning, if you were. My own view, and I think the majority of us will agree, I have my own ideological and policy differences with Trey. I mean, I would, given my ideological predisposition. But so do other members of the ANC. But you know what? This is a department where the people who are very, very hard to listen. Look how young they are. Right? And they're more and more demographically. So what I'm saying, you can go if you want, but the truth is, we must encourage people to participate in the parliament. And people are free to leave when they want. Okay, fine. Over to you.
Can we just get the ruling that the stakeholders just obliged to for Tandy's help and the other members' questions or remarks, and then we'll give the opportunity to do the final input, and then also Karim will do the wrap-up for us before we leave. You know the process, so thank you.
Chief, can I maybe suggest that PwC, who goes to that expert, responds to the back question, they can just do so much better than I can. Thanks. Thank you. With regard to your question, the way VAT works is that the VAT must be accounted for when the Act says it must be accounted for, and that is known as the time of supply. So with regard to the proposed amendments regarding non-resident suppliers of electronic services, it has got nothing to do with the VAT rate increase. It's to change the dispensation that there currently is with regard to the registration of non-resident suppliers of electronic services. So if, for example, we use an Amazon, and we had to assume, let us assume that Amazon is not registered for VAT today. If we had to look at what the proposed regulation is doing and what the proposed amendments are doing, it is broadening the scope of services that is saying, when you supply any of these services via the internet, i.e. electronically, and you, the sales, the value of your supplies are more than 50,000 rand, at that point you have got to register as a vendor in South Africa. So it doesn't affect local vendors, it only affects non-resident suppliers. Now what the world has gone and done from an OECD perspective is the world has set up rules that everybody in the world actually follows, so that these global businesses can use the same system to account for VAT in all the different countries. What has happened now is South Africa's proposal with regard to non-resident registration means that we are out of sync with the rest of the world with regard to when these non-resident businesses are required to register for VAT in South Africa. So we are talking about, we are not talking about non-resident electronic service providers, we are talking about non-resident businesses. And those are the ones who are required to register and make the system changes. So the difficulty is that when we look at businesses, all these non-resident global businesses that supply things over the internet, the reality is that when they need to make changes to their system, because now it's not like the rest of the world, we are not following the same principles as New Zealand, Australia, the EU, Canada, Singapore, we're not following those jurisdictions at all, they've got to change their systems to accommodate what we are requiring, or currently what the law is requiring them to do. They will not change those systems until they know exactly what the law says they have to do. So right now they're saying it's a bill, we don't know whether it's going to go through exactly as that, so therefore we don't move. We don't change accounting systems, we don't change billing systems, we don't change anything until we know. And that's why we've asked for the 6 month period. So from a proposal perspective and from a bill perspective, this only relates to non-resident businesses. But currently we do have non-resident businesses that are supplying e-commerce services into the country and they are registered for that. There are some. What the bill is proposing is to extend this list very broadly to every single thing that is supplied over the internet, and where you receive more than 50,000 rand in a year, you've got to register for that in South Africa. I don't know if that answers the, or clarifies the issue.
You follow?
Mr. Chair, the last time I checked, we had about six clauses that were consequential clauses that were dealing with the issue specifically on the VAT agreement. And that's where Yanga and her team must come in, because I understand very well what the lady is referring to. And I still insist it doesn't relate to the 1% increase. The changes that they want to suggest differently from what we're dealing with in the current conjunction. And that's when I want them to respond to this, because then you'll understand the point from where I'm coming from. You see? They will seek to clarify exactly the same.
I get the opportunity. Are you covered?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, the transitional...
Felice.
Yeah. With regard to the retention payments, the VAT Act has got specific transitional rules that it deals with when a VAT rate is going to increase. So it literally says to you, from the 21st of February right up until generally the 22nd of April, there are special rules that apply so that people can't go and play around with different VAT rates and sell things when they actually haven't sold it and expect the VAT rate to be 14%. So what you've got to go and check with your retention payments is to see when was payment due or when is an invoice going to be issued in respect of your retention payment, and then evaluate it in terms of the transitional rules, which is for that specific period, and will then tell you which rate you should apply. So it's not just a simple, I can say it's 14, I can say it's 15.
Sherry, I know whether Mr. Hill is asking for tax advice for his business, it doesn't relate to what you are dealing with.
We're not announcing any kind
like
of business yet. Are you covered, members? Thank you. You're done?
Sorry, just maybe to say that in this draft bill, there is a specific section that, so yes, you've got the 14% to 15%, but there's a separate section that deals with changes in the VAT on e-services. It's a totally different and separate thing, and with that comes draft regulations at the moment.
Thank you. Chris, we're going to you now. All the members, on Saturday afternoon, from 2 o'clock until 6 o'clock, last Saturday, I attended an international meeting where South Africa was commended for budget transparency. And the people who sat in front of me was not South Africans. Yes. And I felt very proud wearing my little flag on my bracelet. Yes. Yes, in another country. Yeah. It's a nice feeling to have.
The DA member there. Pardon?
No, there was no DA member.
Yeah, why not? He was paid for by the parliament to go.
I don't know where he was. I don't know. I just want to share this with you. There's appreciation of what the Treasury is actually doing, and it's our job to keep them accountable. And we must account to the people outside. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I want to clarify the issues regarding incentives. When I was doing my presentation, I said in the budget day, we published e-service regulations, changes to e-service regulations for public comment. Together with that, we made three changes in the rate deal, clause 9, clause 10, clause 11, relating to e-services. So I must say here that the issues that they are raising, they are in the regulations, they are not in the deal. The changes in the bill are consequential to regulations, but the meat of the changes is in the regulations. So, as you have said, this is not the first time the e-service regulations are in South Africa. They were first established in 2014. So we are making changes based on the things because the world is moving. So, as you have said, that end of May we're going to have public consultation, and then we're going to address their issues that they are raising here during the public consultation. The issue is that regulations are not ideal, they're not gonna come to Parliament, but we need to make public consultation in the regulations. And we're gonna deal with the regulations and the issues that they are raising. So that is the first point. And so the second point is the issue of short time period regarding the rate increase and the implementation. We've had meetings with different taxpayers that are raising these issues, and we've told them that they should come here in Parliament because the minister made an announcement that rate will be increasing from 1 April. We do not have a mandate to move the date. It's only Parliament that can move the date. That's all.
Thank you. And just, with the civil society organisations and that increase, we're very open to engaging. And we tried to set up a meeting, because it was quite short between the period, there wasn't enough notice, a couple came, not many, but that didn't mean we were going to stop. We still wanted to engage. We tried to set up another two meetings within the next month before the response. So, we want to meet. I know that some of them said today that we're not being cooperative, but we want to meet, and that's the first start in being cooperative is when we actually sit down and discuss it. So we have committed to that and we are going to. I mean, just on the, with Mr. Meekin, we had a very good engagement with him and others at the Treasury, and then we will respond to them. It's difficult for us to, we can't respond yes or no because it's such a big issue. But we are working on a report, we also don't want to rush it, but maybe we can respond in another way just to show where we are and what's going on in there. Chat about it later, but we will respond. Thank you.
I came out in the engagement. It's a workshop on the 23rd of May. 21st. Okay. You must all register that workshop. The other point is additional and more interaction is needed. Consultation. Yes. The backlog of ideas.
One misconstrues to be dismissive about digital economic activities. We need to make it very clear that the sector must differentiate between our legislative role and the role that we play in the establishment of regulations. To the extent that we look at the impact of the regulations to the legislation and how it will affect tax collection, it's at that point then we engage. But to this extent, it's for you to engage National Treasury on matters that create complexities in terms of tax collection or accountability of companies in relation to the tax system that took place over jurisdictions that are not necessarily African jurisdictions. But to this extent, there's limitations with how we can interact with such regulations, unless if there's a direct impact on legislation. So I think we should understand, that's why I was saying to you, separate the process of how we deal with the 1% increase and how regulations impact generally, globally, and how you find canvas in terms of recording its impact. So, Chair, I think on those bases, we might want to have feedback. It would not be bad to have feedback on the engagement that you have with the National Challenge, specifically on this issue, at a later stage. I think we are always open to that engagement and we have dealt with them.
Thank you, Chair.
No, I'm just saying, you will hear all of you, you know the process. The only thing that we all agree to, Mr. Lisa, I spoke to Mr. Mania briefly, right, is that given the deadline we were not expected to take for the panel, etc., I'm not going to cover that ground, we have to review the whole program. We have to bring forward the, what's the other bill? The carbon tax bill, and move this further down, because everybody needs more time. So having said that, I'm not going to cover the ground. I think you should go to a close call, Chair. I'm down for our side.
Honourable members, thank you for your commitment attending this public hearing, listening to all the valuable inputs, also to the staff that arranged this public hearing. I wish you well. Be careful of the traffic, whatever is outside waiting for us. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you. I think he was engaged with the advocate. He's not yet.
What's that?
Yeah.
Peter Lucy. Peter Lucy.